Welcome to Behind the Splinters, a limited series interview podcast about the making of 12 Monkeys. This is Brandy, or Beep, as I'm more commonly referred to on the interwebs. I live in the Atlanta area and happen to be a fan of brilliantly written genre shows, so I think that explains my presence here, because 12 Monkeys certainly fits that description. I am joined, as always, by the lovely Cece.
Hi there, I'm Tina. I'm a recovering lawyer in Washington, D.C., and this is how I channel my frustrations as a former English major. I'm a huge fan of both genre TV and film, as well as period pieces, and so a time travel show is basically my ultimate happy place.
If you are also a giant 12 Monkeys fan, you may recognize our voices from the rewatch podcast Word of the Witnesses, where we brought in several of our fellow fangirls and broke down every episode of the series and how they all connect. That podcast also includes several interviews with the writers, cast, and other behind-the-scenes folks. You can find Word of the Witnesses on all major podcast platforms. And we'd also love for you to engage with us on Twitter at 12mRewatchPod.
For this podcast, we want to tell the behind-the-scenes story of the making of one of TV's great science fiction shows. And so we will be talking to many different creative departments, such as costumes, set design, writers, and directors, so that we can highlight their incredible work and fans can better understand the process of making a television show. We couldn't tell the behind-the-scenes story without the support of the very generous people behind this show, and in particular, we want to thank co-creator and showrunner Terry Metalis for his support of this project. First up, a conversation with Terry Metalis and Travis Fickett, co-creators of Syfy's 12 Monkeys, about writing and developing the pilot.
Please enjoy now as we go behind the splinters. All right. So today we have with us co-creators of 12 Monkeys, the television series, Terry Metalis and Travis Fickett. Thank you guys so much for being here with us. We appreciate you guys a lot.
Thanks for doing it.
You're welcome.
So we understand, and I know a lot of listeners, watchers may not know this, but that you guys were actually college roommates.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yes.
Right.
Yes, okay. We were.
So what, like, did you guys used to dream about making TV that you would, you know, in your dorm room, or like what shows or movies that were, you know, were super formative to your process?
Oh boy. Yes. Trav, do you want to start? What do you want to do?
Oh, formative? I mean, I remember stuff that we saw together in college that changed us. Pulp Fiction was one.
Yeah, Pulp
Seven
Fiction
was another.
Many times. The Prophecy, Christopher Walken's movie, The Prophecy, we saw. Did we even see it more than once? I don't know.
I think we might have, but Seven, I remember Seven wrecked Terry.
Yeah.
It
did. Still does.
Especially at the end, we're in the theater and the credits started going backwards and Terry just goes, why?
Yeah.
It was just such a messed up experience. What else?
Legends of the Fall.
Yeah, in a hate way.
Yeah. Travis was a year older than me. I was a freshman who got thrown into a dorm room with a couple of sophomores. And we had we weren't even supposed to be roommates. It was like a glitch or something.
So you guys graduate from college and you both move out to LA?
Yeah. Well, Emerson has a program where, you know, Emerson's in Boston, as far removed from the industry as you can get. But they have a program where the last semester you come to Los Angeles and you live in Burbank and you get an internship and you get real industry experience and do all of that kind of stuff. So I did that, and then the following year, Terry did the same thing, and we both ended up staying.
And so how did you all start writing as a duo? And how does that actually work when two people are writing together?
We actually started together fairly early. We wrote together a little bit in college, and then we wrote together a little bit once Terry came out to L.A. And then that was sort of a fits and starts attempt. I think it was around 2007 that we started writing Maxwell House, which was just for fun because I was working in a post-production house and Terry was working as an assistant at Star Trek, and we were both going crazy. So we started, I think, did I send you the first sentence?
I don't know. It was just an idea. It was a writing exercise where we were going to just write something and have no idea what the other person wrote it and had to respond, and then just keep writing as if it was a novel. And I think I don't know. It might have been me, because it sounds like something dumb I would do. Like I said, like Maxwell House, like holstered his gun and blah blah. Like it was supposed to be like something so dumb that it took the pressure off of, like, it'd be like, it's okay. Like, there's no pressure to writing this at all. So you can have fun with it. So you just felt different about your writing. It evolved into a time travel story with elements some of it we wanted to use for Splinter.
Well, not so much so that's the origin of the character Max's name.
Yeah, in the first draft of the 12 Monkey script, his name was Max. Not House, though, because that would have been ridiculous. I don't think he had a last name. I think he said, "My name is Max," and she's like, "Max who?" And he's like, "It's just Max." But that was also in a pilot where, like, he was coming from like 200 years in the future. In the first Splinter, it wasn't so close to when the world died.
Right. And he was a little bit more of a superhero.
Yeah, he had like nanobites that did shit and things. I wouldn't call him a superhero. But
he had powers.
Yeah. So this is just this ridiculous story. And we started sharing it with friends because it actually was really cool. And then they were like, "Can you get us the next chapter?" And it was like this thing that we would just send only to our friends. And then like, per tradition at that point in our writing partnership, we never finished it. So then the next step towards 12 Monkeys was if we wanted to break in, I was already working in the industry as an assistant, and Travis was working in development and film acquisition, that if we wanted to break in, we knew we needed a spec script, a spec pilot. Something. And so we wanted to write a show called Spearhead. And what it was about was the government facility prior to a disaster in which all of the heads of state and VIPs,
key scientists
would be sheltered in case of an apocalypse of some kind. And the teaser of it was this amazing sort of montage of people from all walks of life being grabbed by government officials to be helicoptered in before. And you never knew exactly, like, they got in and the doors closed and something happened and you never knew exactly what happened outside. Which is still a cool pilot. As I pitched this, I'm like, "Hey, we should do this."
Yeah, because
I kind of love this story.
I'd like to watch that.
one of the ideas was that there was a sort of ongoing mystery of, can we open the doors to look outside, to go outside? And it's like, we don't know how deadly it is. We don't
or know what it what is. Happened. Or why, right? Who ordered it. But the idea was that it was an outdated program that hadn't been updated. In fact, they went to like go grab a doctor at the doctor's house who's important. And then they knock on the door and they're like, "Are you Dr. Sorensen or whatever?" And he's like, "Yes, I am." They're like, "Please come with me." And they usher him into the helicopter and takes off. And then the camera just stays in his doorway as you sort of dolly back to see a dead body there. And you realize that was the real doctor is dead and they've got somebody else. They have a serial killer. Man, that was a cool idea. And so what happened was it was one of these amazing premise pilots, right? Where, and they still happen. I still see them all the time. Where, in fact, I just watched a series of an amazing premise pilot and then it just fell apart. Where it was like, "But what's the show?" And we couldn't crack it because you're like, well, you know, you have the character stories inside and possibly starting up a government again, which felt a little familiar to Battlestar Galactica. But then it was like, I don't know, like, something really cool has to be happening out there.
Well, I remember it being like the winning, any kind of solution was so far off in the future of these characters that it just lacked any kind of drive or urgency. A little bit like Walking Dead when you're like, what are they doing?
Yeah,
what
are that's they my really problem. Doing? Yeah, exactly.
Like they're just, what's the they're just surviving here? Day to day. That's right. It. So we're like
all of us.
So we're like, how can it become more urgent to solve this problem? And then it became, well, we have to stop it from ever happening in the first place.
Right. It became a time travel story. And so that was the idea. I think it was Travis, like, maybe it's a time travel story. And I mean, it was like, that's my, in my DNA, as you know. So one day I just started, we would get pulled away from our jobs because we were both working quite a bit. And I just wrote like 10 pages. I was just like, I didn't even know where it was going. And it was basically the whole opening with, at that time it was Max and his friend who became Ramsey walking in the apocalypse. Instead of just scavs, they were actual, like, it was more like The Last of Us. Where, yeah,
mutant, horrifying.
Yeah,
with milky eyes, remember?
Milky white eyes and fucked up skin. And so that was more like the infected were a threat in the future. But they were still it was the opening, going through the CDC and finding Cassie. Her name is Cassie because I just always liked the name, and I knew, like, you could do a cool Cassandra thing because where the story was going to go. And it was the Watch, and leading to her at the hospital. She gets abducted in the car. At that time, brought back to like this dingy apartment. And Max does the Watch paradoxy thing there, or not paradoxing, where he cuts the watch, and there was like a countdown. Like, he knew he was going to splinter, and he was like out of time. It was like a super desperate first act, where like he needed to get this information about, at the time it wasn't Leland Frost, it was Mason Frost.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah. such a TV name. And leading to the whole first act where just he gets shot by the cops and he splinters away. Like, all that was just, and I handed it to Travis. So I was like, now let's go. And so we just kept writing it, and, you know, chunk at a time, ultimately to the point where we got them to where they were caught by Mason Frost. And I remember that's what we were stuck, and we were stuck there for like a month. Like, we didn't know what happened or what the way out of it was. And it was Travis who came up with the Watch paradox thing. Which is a little bit like, what's that terrible movie with Jean-Claude Van Damme? Time Cop?
Yeah.
There's like some rules in Time Cop. Time Cop.
Wait a minute. Yeah, but it's not terrible.
I don't remember it.
What a horrible thing to say.
Is it bad? Is it good? It's Peter Hyams, right? I mean, yeah. I do like the Peter Hyams. Anyway, so, and that got it out, and we had the script. And go ahead, take it away, Trev. I don't know.
I don't. I mean, yeah, I think we were writing because we had a few spec scripts that we ended up writing. So we may have been writing other things at the time and going back and forth. Do you remember? Like, I mean, don't remember.
Yeah, we were. I mean, we didn't finish anything. I remember, like, at one point, I came down to Sherman Oaks and I, like, sat you down. I'm like, we need to finish this script. I don't know why, but I really feel like we have to finish it. But we never intended to sell it. That was the other thing that's so kind of interesting about it. Like, in fact, when we cleaned it up and it got into the hands of our manager, this gentleman who ended up becoming our manager. He was like, so what do you want to do? You want to sell it? And Travis and I looked at each other like, you can do that?
Yeah, we were thinking it was a staffing sample, which it ended up becoming for us at the, in the same, you know, capacity as being sold. But that was the goal, was like, let's just prove that we can write and then see what happens.
And then the rest was this weird synergy, like, thing where it was everybody really responded to the script, to Splinter. And it ended up, our manager got it into the hands of Keith Goldberg, who runs Dark Horse, everything Dark Horse right now on television, like Umbrella Academy, which ironically shoots on the 12 Monkeys sound stages. And anyway, so, and Keith Goldberg had just left Atlas, which had the rights to 12 Monkeys. And he was like, you know, this really feels like 12 Monkeys. You should let Atlas read it. And we're like, sure, whatever. So then we had this meeting with Chuck Roven, who's, you know, juggernaut, iconic film producer who made the movie 12 Monkeys, and Richard Suckle, who also made it, also juggernaut producer. And they said, you know, this is really great. Could you turn this into 12 Monkeys? And we were like, sure. I mean, yeah. And then
we were so green in that meeting that we didn't even have agents yet. We were just like, it was our first meeting, professional meeting as writers, having only gotten ourselves a manager. So we're like so just terrified sitting in this meeting and thinking, oh man, like these guys are want to turn this into 12 Monkeys. And I remember thinking, that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, you're dumb.
Why is that? Because you know, we went back and watched some of your like interviews back in season one, and you all had said that your instinct was don't do it. And is that because it was, I wanted to unpack that about.
Well, you couldn't, 12 Monkeys is like the movie is a perfect sort of puzzle box. Right. So, I mean, we say don't do it, but the opportunity to turn Splinter into an actual sellable IP was obviously too good to be true. So we that had to happen. But it couldn't be the same aesthetic, right? Like I remember even sitting with Chuck Rove and he's like, I don't think it could be a Gillian movie every week. Like there's an exhaustion to everything that's amazing about Terry Gilliam. Could you do 50 hours of that over the, I mean, maybe someone could do it, but we were like, no, we wanted to lean into, and they originally had envisioned the movie as more of a thriller adventure. And so we were like, we think we could probably do that better than trying to crib Terry Gilliam. But for me, like, I remember thinking right in the meeting, I was like, oh, I know how you do that. Max comes back, but he doesn't know. He comes back, but looking for Mason Frost. But what Mason Frost will tell him is like, you're not looking for me. You're looking for the Army of the 12 Monkeys. And I remember, and I pulled this from when I first saw the trailer and the movie 12 Monkeys when I was a kid, which was basically, I thought there was something so mysterious and weird about the name of the Army of the 12 Monkeys. And then almost disappointed that they weren't this cool secret cabal, that they ended up being this other thing, which is, you know, obviously I don't feel that way now when you look at it, it's perfect. But I was like, well, what if they really are like the threat? And that was kind of it. And so the next part of it was, and Travis can speak more to this, which was we adapted it and turned it in to 12 Monkeys. And then we went out and everybody loved the script and nobody wanted to make it. And the Sci-Fi Channel passed on it three times we were in there before they said yes. And there was a new exec who came in, Paul Shapiro, who was like, you guys, finally, it was like, you guys, we really should be doing this. Like, we want to go back to our Battlestar roots. This is that. But it was like 3-4 years to the point in which I didn't want to take another phone call about 12 Monkeys anymore because we had been on so many meetings and we got very close. Like BBC America wanted them to do it. And Universal was like, no, that's our property. Well, we're going to do it.
That's what made it, I think, enticing to
Universal.
Yeah. Is that somebody else wanted it and they were like, what? No, wait, we've been saying no, but now somebody else wants it and it's our toy. We want to play with that. And it, I think, made it a viable property in their eyes, which it hadn't been prior to that. Also, from the beginning, when we were pitching it, we had no experience. We were an unknown quantity and people thought like who, you know, who are these people? And we ended up, you know, working in between the first time we took 12 Monkeys out to when we, you know, four years later, when we were still shopping it around, but we had worked on Terra Nova, we'd worked on Nikita, we had experience and people now knew us. So I think it just meant that we were more viable as well. And it was just that confluence of events that led it to, you know, you're always just pushing that meter in between yes and no, and you just got to get it over that into that red zone where someone will actually go, I've run out of reasons to say no, so why don't we do this?
So that moment, that, so what is it, the third or fourth time when Sci-Fi finally says, let's do it, you all had written on other TV shows, and I know that you had folks as sort of official showrunner and helping you, but all of a sudden you're now taking this from, you know, a pilot that you have been writing to explain to us, like, what happens next, producing a pilot.
It went pretty quickly from the time that they bought it. They bought it and we had to rewrite a little bit from
we
had, that point.
We took the zombies out.
We did. That sucked. I remember that being kind of a letdown.
But at that time, I mean, it was literally at the peak of Walking Dead.
Right.
And we wanted to make them different enough, but like it would have been really interesting to have, imagine in 2043 that there's another threat out there that's just not scavs. That's not a bunch of just homeless people that attack houses. You know what I mean? Like it was, there was a real scary element that was a constant visual reminder of it. It's not just saving 7 million, it's saving, you know, the few remaining people that are being hunted into extinction here. You know, it was this cool idea, maybe for our next one.
Well, it was also just a visual sort of representation of what the virus could do. It just, as long as it was more horrific and everything, it just gave Cole that much more drive. But I think it also would have been one idea too many, ultimately.
Yeah, totally. Definitely.
Yeah. So we had to finish writing the last season of...
Nikita.
And what's funny is that Nikita was on the bubble of getting picked up or not, and it ended up only getting picked up for 6 episodes. Now, if it had been picked up for the full 22, that would have conflicted with us being able to make 12 Monkeys. I don't know if we would have had to have walked away.
We would have had to have walked away. We would have.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, yeah. I guess
not.
I don't know if contractually that would have been a mess, but it ended up working out perfectly because we did the 6 episodes and then walked right into essentially the development process of, you know, casting and all of that for 12 Monkeys and writing the Bible.
So yeah. with respect to casting, you have, you know, it's interesting because you're writing Splinter and you had sort of, I assume, an idea of who these characters were. You then adapt it, you know, turn it into 12 Monkeys. Can you all walk us through what you had in your head when you imagined Cole or Cassie or Jones, and then how that might have shifted or changed as you went through the casting process?
It was really hard to cast this show. So in the eyes of, I think, some of the producers, we were the kids, right? I think a lot of people were coming from features and they're like, don't worry, we got this. We know how to cast the thing. But it was also, there was a lot of shows going. We weren't seeing as many people as we needed to see, and we had to do it fast. Like it was, the show was picked up cast contingent, meaning we are going to say we want to do this, but we want to see your Cole and Cassie first. And we need to love them. And if we don't, then we have the right to say we don't want to make this. So the pressure was on. And we saw a lot of people. I mean, we met with, people who would go on to be wearing Mandalorian armor and anything from all over the place. But it was I think we all had a kind of a different version of what Cole could be. and including Travis and I, at one point we actually went down the road casting somebody who wasn't right for me, but was right for a lot of other people. It was really hard. Like it was hard for me to, and that led to a Cassie too that I wasn't 100% sure about. Like we took it hard, and Travis got, you know, like Travis was one, he liked this other choice, and there's nothing wrong. It's just a different, would have just been a different show. There's nothing wrong with liking it, but
that's the key element of casting is you're not just looking for someone that's going to, you start off thinking, okay, I'm going to find somebody that can play this role, and then the project will remain the script that we wrote. But the truth is, once you put somebody in that role, everything forms around that person. The show becomes different. It becomes the show starring this person.
Right. And there's a tone that changes. Like, if you hire, you know, if you're going to hire, who plays Bane? What's that guy? Tom Hardy, right? Okay. So if you hire Tom Hardy to play your main.
No one will hear the whole show. They
right, okay,
hear a
but,
thing.
But that's one show, right? If you hire Keanu Reeves, that's a totally different thing, right? If you hire, you know, so it's just even the same words, but a different person changes the tone. And I didn't like the tone that we were in. We ended up going down the road, like we cast a whole other Cole and Cassie. I think back on this moment. Like I was horrible. I was horrible to Travis because he was supporting this idea. And it wasn't, he just felt, right? There was no reason to be, but like, I really felt that it was wrong. And Travis is like, you're being a monster. We're getting our pilot made with, and these were good actors. These were not bad actors. That's another thing I want to say. It was just different. And then ultimately what happened is it all fell apart anyway. The deal, it was a crazy deal with this actor who had a bunch of demands. And ultimately the network was like, no. And so now we were in real trouble. Do you remember that, Trav?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. They weren't diva demands. They were personal life changing moment in demands that this guy wanted to do a certain thing. And the network and the studio were just like, nope. And they were like, everybody kind of thought he was going to bend because of course they wanted to make a TV show. And then the actor was like, nah, I'm good. See you later.
Yeah.
It was kind of shocking. And then we thought that was it. We thought our pilot was dead.
And so they were like, you have 1 week to cast your show. And Amanda was somebody like, for me, I always saw Amanda, like Amanda is kind of what I saw in my head when I first wrote Cassie in Splinter, which was the all American girl next door doctor, or just, you know, she just had that like put together erudite quality that you could then rough up over the course of 5 years of a story and turn her into, you know, a scav. And so Amanda was kind of already on and had already tested with the network a bunch of times and was on. So we knew she was a likely candidate, but Cole was we didn't know. Now, Aaron Stanford, who we worked with on Nikita, had read for Ramsey when this other actor worked, and we loved the read. And at the time, our director didn't watch the audition, and so we went back. We were driving. We were like, "What about Aaron? Like, it's a non-traditional." Remember, we were on the 405. It's like we should get Aaron in here, and we reached out.
The casting reached out to Aaron and said they'd like you to come in and read for Cole. And Aaron called us and said, I think they sent me the wrong thing. They said that they want me to read for Cole. And we're like, no, that's the right thing. And he's like, you want me to read for the lead? And yeah. He was like surprised. He didn't think that that was right for him at all. And it's true that when you read the script, like that's people get a certain actor, a certain type of person in their head. And this would make the show different by casting him. And that's what we decided we wanted to take a shot at that and make it a different show.
But he had that sort of gritty, hurt puppy thing that was exactly right. Like, there's just a charm to Aaron. And so we got, anyway, there was a bunch of actors. We had to have an emergency casting session on a Saturday that we weren't even supposed to have, but some of these agents were like, no fucking way are we sending our actor back in there. It was all on the line, and it was a Saturday morning, and first up was Aaron Stanford and Amanda Shule, which you can actually watch on the DVDs. It's that moment. And that was it. The second he was done, he said, thank you so much. We were all like, it's him. Let's just stop this. Let's just go. Let's try and get this approved. And, we, you know, he wasn't your traditional CW lead actor. You know what I mean? So we weren't sure we were going to be able to get him approved, but depending on who, you know, up high on the network would have expected. But it all worked out. And it was Amanda and Aaron.
Oh, I remember the director of the pilot, Jeffrey Reiner. What he said about Aaron was that in his acting, there are no false notes. And that was, I thought that was such a high compliment, but it's also, it's just true. It's the kind of actor that he is. And that, so the idea of making the show with that level of performance and to have your hero be essentially a character actor, somebody who can create that kind of feel and vibe, it would be much more interesting.
Yeah, it's funny because as you all were describing that, he's a protagonist that is so relatable, you know, as opposed to like that more kind of like
Bruce Willis,
like a superhero. Right. Yeah. Which, given that, even though Cole sort of starts out kind of in that anti-hero mode, given that this is a ultimately this like season long redemption story, that relatability, I think, ends up, you know, it's why it's so emotional for the audience, because it's easier to picture yourself in that person's shoes, right, than if it's like Keanu Reeves type actor. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you get he's just a much more versatile tool as an actor, and you get to play a lot more than you think you would. And it makes for a very different story. It gives you a lot more latitude.
So tell us about casting Jones.
Well, Jones is a tough one. We saw a lot of really great, really terrific actors of note, and all of which could have been fantastic. But there was a quality we wanted almost from the film. From the Jones character from the film, like this very stern doctor. And as we were describing it to, he's like, cause I think Jeffrey would have been fine with almost any Jones. And when I kept pushing back. I'm like, I want this. He's like, you want Barbara, Sukowa.
Yeah. Barbara Sukowa from,
and we were like,
I'm like,
who's that?
Right? Talking about,
and he goes, just let me make a phone call. And so he gets our casting person, and then we get this phone audition, which I think is on one of I think it's on one of the DVDs, and it's just her, she's just skipping the other person's lines and she's doing it into her phone, and it was like, that Jones, it was obviously her from the like every quality we wanted was her.
It was the German accent, the authority, the look. It was
severe perfect. But warm, like there was, it was, that was kind of easy. And she said yes. She was living in New York at the time. I mean, we thought she was in Germany because she won all these German Academy Awards and whatnot. And so, yeah, we had her, which
and
brought
she some... wasn't she, but she wasn't somebody that was out there running around doing auditions, like,
not at all. No,
like we that was such a out of left field suggestion from Jeffrey, who just dug into his, you know, German cinema knowledge.
Yeah.
And it just ended up being perfect.
But what it demanded, which is right, was I remember when we were writing the second episode of the series, and Natalie gave us a draft, first draft of that, and was like, okay, what do you guys want to do? And we stepped in and took over, and we had shot the pilot, and Barbara was like just one of the most intoxicating parts of that pilot. Like when she comes in and you're just like, who is this woman? And Jones had like three lines in the second episode. And then I went and I watched this, this movie Barbara did called Hannah Arendt, which is about, you know, the German, is a philosopher or whatever, who, yeah, you know, who coined the phrase, banality of evil, during the Nuremberg trials. And Barbara was amazing. It has this tour de force monologue at the end that's like 10 minutes long that by the end you're like, okay, I mean, this is the kind of actor we have now. And let's crank this up, which is why at the end of episode two, there's that big blow up between her and Cole, and trying to formalize that relationship into something concrete, like as the cornerstone of what the series could be. And that's all just because of Barbara, you know? She just does that. Once she starts talking, you're like, I want more of this.
I think one thing that might surprise fans is if you sit down and read the 2013 pilot script that you all were kind enough to share with us, Jennifer Goines is not in it.
That's right.
Yeah. Can you talk to us all about, I mean, Terry, you've told us in the past, was it your wife's idea to turn Jeffrey Goines into Jennifer?
Well, we were going to do Jeffrey Goines. In fact, when we always knew you couldn't do that show. Remember, Trav, we were like up in Toronto and Aaron Stanford's like, I want to play Jeffrey Goines. And we were like, it's yours. Like when we do the show, you'll be Jeffrey Goines. It'll be amazing. We got to the process of the script and it felt like it didn't really have like an ending that promised more story. It kind of was like written like a conclusion.
Jeffrey was not going to be in the pilot.
Right. And then we said, you know what? We really should. We should throw to him at the end. It's a big promise for if you're a 12 Monkeys fan for that character. And it's like, you know, you just killed this man's father. You start to put the puzzle pieces together. Like maybe this is the next link of the conspiracy or whatever. And then there was this thing where it was like the shadow of Brad Pitt. Like, are we ever going to get – I mean, sure, you can get somebody different. But, like, it's just not that great an opportunity. And I remember I was like – I said – it's like I said something – like my wife was sitting in the room. And I was like, I mean, you'd want to give that opportunity. I said, you want to give this opportunity to a woman. And then, like, I said it but didn't, like, kind of, like, go all the way with it. And she's like, so why don't you do that? And then I was like, yeah, here's how you could play it out, blah, blah, blah. So I called Trav. I was like, Trav, how great would this be? Let's get some amazing woman to take over the thing. And
I was like, women? Gross. No.
And then we were like, all right, let's see if we can get. And what we didn't think we could do was convince Atlas, who owned the rights, who made the movie with Brad Pitt, because it was such an important role for them making that film. But no, right away, they're like, you know what? That could be really cool. So then it was, we have 3 days to find a Jennifer Goines, which is not good before shooting the pilot. But, you know, if we went to series, we could always, like, find our Jennifer Goines then. And we found somebody who's really terrific in the pilot to shoot. And then ultimately, when we came to series, the pressure from the networking studio was like, let's go reexamine this role again. And open it up to a million and one more auditions. And I saw every human being as Jennifer Goines. Oh my God.
That scene, we just heard those same lines. And that's, by the way, one of the challenges of casting is you get so sick of hearing those same words. And that people can come in and do a perfectly fine job, but you've just seen it so many times that you're waiting for something surprising. You're waiting, you're like literally you're hoping someone's going to come in like on a tricycle in a clown outfit and just do something insane so that you're like, oh, okay. I haven't thought of it this way.
And but it's also, it's punishment too. It's punishment. Like you get to hear your own bad dialogue said poorly. You know what I mean? And you're just like, there's no reason we should be doing this. We should just go home and
be fired, exiled from Hollywood,
open up a taco deli. And then so, but a great a great actor comes in and you're like, oh, well, I'm a little brilliant, aren't I? Listen to that. So Emily Hampshire was buried in, it turned out she read for Kathy and it wasn't right. I don't even think I saw the audition. But she also read for this. And I was just like, I think this is Jennifer. And it was like it had glitched out, like the uplink or whatever. You can only see some of it, but it was like the way she had this like smile and the way she said monkeys. And Emily has crazy eyes. I mean, I think she'll be the first to tell you, like, Emily is Jennifer Goins. There was just a thing, like, you knew right away that this actress could do scary, could do funny, could do all these other things that I think that this role needed to have. And so, and that was its own battle, by the way. Then we had to bring her in from Canada, fly her in.
Battle because the people could not get out of their head the Brad Pitt dynamic, which was you took a movie star and you gave him a character role. And people were like, this is going to be the role that we're going to stunt cast. And we're going to get somebody that people know. And we're going to put them into a role that stretches them and reintroduces them to people. And they did not want to introduce somebody. They wanted to put somebody, they wanted to put a name quantity into that role. And it was almost a non-starter for us to even talk about somebody like Emily, who wasn't, you know, in some way famous, even in like, at least like the science fiction world or something. And they were like, no, has to be. And we read every name like that you haven't even heard of since, like, you know, were they in Short Circuit too? Great, perfect. Let's throw them up there. Like, it was everybody.
I remember our studio executive is a very good friend of ours. Now I remember I was at the gym in the morning, and I was impulsive and crazy. I would have just been like, "Let's Emily Hampshire." I was like, "Emily Hampshire, let's just go." We got her. And the studio was like, no, we're going to take a couple weeks and we're going to do this and that. And I got an email saying they wanted to go out to somebody who I really was like, someone you haven't heard of in a long time, who wouldn't, I mean, you'd laugh if I said it because it's just not right for the role. But that person had a name, and I'm no longer this producer, but I was at the gym. I remember I called her, and poor Travis had to be like, he was like, good copy. It was Stacy. I could call it Stacy. And
Stacy Fung, our
Stacy Fung,
studio executive.
And like lifelong friend forever. I just was like, are you out of your mind? What? Why are we even this? What a waste of time. And Trav, you know, I mean, Trav was very much like, it's fine, let's go with the flow. You're wigging out about Jennifer Goins. Relax.
I don't remember the person you're talking about at all.
You want me to say it, and then you can cut. You guys can cut it from the broadcast or bleep it. You guys can bleep it, so fans forever want to know. It was.
Oh right. Yeah. Oh, that's right.
And I was like, what? Why would you even say she's a name? Like, and because she was a like, I don't even know why.
Now you gotta bleep a lot now.
Yeah, bleep all that out. So, okay.
Wow.
By the way, I'm sure that person's a lovely person and has, you know, gone on to do things, but they wouldn't have been right for this role. Anyway, it was fine. We ultimately had to do a screen test with Emily and Aaron and get everybody's Atlas and everybody to sign off. And we did. And that was that.
Wow. So, and then let's round out with Kirk Acevedo and Ramsey.
Yeah. Kirk came in and read for Cole early on. And it was a fantastic audition. It was easily one of the best Coles. And totally would have made that show. There was such intensity to his performance, though, that it required the rest of the show to be in that tone. And so, which would have been, by the way, a really cool show. It would have been like an AMC, darker, fucked up.
Like Oz.
And ultimately, it was, you know, what do you want the show to be? And but Ramsay for us was always the second important character in the show, because we knew what his turn was going to be for the season. We knew where that character was going to be in the series. So we knew we needed some fantastic actor to take on that role. But in the pilot, there was like three lines. And ultimately, because of runtime, that scene got cut, unfortunately. But I called Kirk and I said, look, you'd be a perfect call. Let me just tell you about this other character. Would you be into it? Like, I talked him through it. And he was like, yeah, I'm in. And so the rest is history. But like, then we shot this pilot and he did give this great performance, which is also on the DVDs, deleted scene for season one, where he comes up to Cole in the machine. He's like, look, I can get you out of this. We can kill everybody in this fucking room and you do not have to go back in time. And you got to, like, you know, they had great chemistry, Aaron and Kirk. Like, you really believed that those two grew up together in the apocalypse. And then we had to cut that scene, which was heartbreaking. Now I would have just been like, no, we have to keep that scene. We have to. And they would have let us. But
I mean, the pilot was 78 minutes long, so we did have to cut quite a bit. The original cut of the pilot is like an independent movie. It's like, it's kind of amazing.
Two things about comparing the pilot that we watched versus the pilot script that you shared. Two things struck us. The first is that in the pilot script you all shared with us from 2013, it is all very much from Cole's point of view, whereas the pilot script is split much more evenly between Cassie and Cole. So one scene that fans love is sort of when Cassie's going to go meet Cole at that hotel. We see things much more from her perspective in the pilot, where she's waiting at the bar, right? The bartender thinks she's kind of like, it's kind of feels sorry for her. And in the pilot, it was all from Cole's point of view. So was that something that you all came up with as you were filming the pilot, or just sort of as you were revising the script?
Yeah, that wasn't even a note. That was even a note. I mean, Act One. So Act One is mostly from Cassie's point of view, right? Mm-hmm. So even though you have like that teaser in the beginning, that's Cole. Your introduction to the story really is through Cassie. And I think as we were doing our own revisions, we were just like, in order to maximize the change she would go through in those 2 years, why not stay with her, have her like be at that hotel, think it's not going to happen, and then just when she like is ready to walk away, he shows up. Because I remember in the original draft, like, it's from Cole's point of view, and like it's the same thing, but from his perspective is, oh shit, she didn't believe me, I'm gonna die. And then which by the way would have worked great. And then she, at the last minute, she's like, come with me. And then she's like, you see, she's this whole other person who's like prepared and has medical equipment and new. But it meant that she believed. And so you had more opportunity to tell it from her story this way. But that was just something I think we did.
I think it just grew, like the idea of her as a character grew too. Because, you know, like we said, like Cole and that character, we had told that story before in a silly novella that we wrote. And then, so later when it became Splinter and ultimately 12 Monkeys, the character of Cassie just became more real and just sort of, you know, organically became more a part of the story.
Yeah. It also, it's in that moment, the character you sitting in, you know, the decade we're sitting in can relate to. Right, that this is this crazy thing that happens to her, and then what would that do to your life? It was interesting just to see that that contrast. The other, and I want to make sure that we took away the right from reading the script. I think it might surprise people. There isn't the time machine in this version is inside Cole's body. Are we gathering? Did we glean the right? As opposed to a physical time machine?
Yeah, there was, well, yes, that he was a biological machine. It's still kind of the component. It's the injections. It's the, you know, sure, nanos and things like that. But, yeah, there was no, like, big giant apparatus in the pilot, but then it just felt like you're gonna want to see a giant apparatus. Like, it's just too cool. And so that's where that came from, was like, just make it two components. Yeah, then you can see it in some of the auditions. There was he was computing in his brain, like he was a biological computer, so he was working, he'd be like muttering numbers, so it was like very Rain Man-esque.
And that's one of the things that seeing it over and over again, we grew to hate so thoroughly.
Yeah, you're like, don't read the numbers, don't fucking, oh, he's reading the numbers, great, you know. And it's cool, it's very cool in the read, it's very cool, like it's just like, do you want to see that every episode, him fucking doing that,
Rain Manning?
Yeah. It was, it just wasn't a good idea.
I know it was a long time ago, but do you have any distinct memories? Like, you know, this is the first time you all were in the process of producing something that was your vision, as opposed to writing for another show. And when you were in, you know, sort of filming the pilot, watching the set design, can you talk to us sort of about, because I imagine that was a pretty incredible experience. Any distinct memories you have, like first time you saw the time machine, things like that?
it was cold in Detroit. That's, you know, December.
No, this is a long answer, because I think Terry will agree to this. It wasn't like the dream that you're promised, because yeah. Like he said, we were viewed as the kids, because we were coming off of you know, being story editors on Nikita, and we did not have a long track record of producing TV and pilots and all that. And so, and this is a lesson for anybody that does make a pilot or makes anything, is that as a wise man said to us, that you are going to be surrounded by people who are older and have more experience and will not have the right answers. Mm-hmm. And we had to fight for every little piece of our own vision on our own pilot. And we had to fight to be heard. We had to stand our ground more than once.
Yeah.
In very uncomfortable
screaming matches on set. Let's just, we'll call it what it is.
Yeah. And it was like, to compare the pilot experience to once the show was actually greenlit and we were in Toronto and actually in charge, it's night and day. And so it was nice to see these things and that we created and to see them manifest. But then you'd see them and they wouldn't be quite what you wanted. And to make the adjustments was a Herculean battle that you can't even imagine. And just to say, hey, this isn't quite right. And it was almost like you'd get a pat on the head and a go sit down little one.
Go get your shine box.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, and some of that actually translated into season one, too. Like, if I look at season one, I can see a lot of compromises and a lot of pressure to do things, tell the story in a way that might have been a bit more traditional than certainly the confidence we had by season two.
One, everybody's learning. They're learning how to make the show.
They're learning how to make the show. But we also, like, the kind of – I mean, I can tell you I wouldn't do a lot of 12 Monkeys Over, but there are big portions of season one I would definitely revise. I think that there are things that we did wrong that we just didn't know that we were doing wrong, or we had caved to the pressure of it should be this kind of show and you need to listen to the network when they say they don't understand the time travel and you need to have a million and one year cards and you need to make this. And so that was – but that's just – making television, you know, and I think it was, and in comparison, I think we've had it easier. I've since then been on bigger, larger shows that have a whole lot more voices and demands that make you go, it's a miracle anything is ever good. So, yeah, it's hard.
Are
Are there any, I mean, just thinking back to the way this started with trading lines back and forth, which is as a writing exercise, which is so great. Are there moments, though, that like if you were, when you were watching it being filmed or watching that first cut of the pilot, are there moments that stick out to you all that you're like, that is what was in my head?
Oh, I mean, I think Zelko, for sure, giving that speech about was exactly, you know, I mean, and even Aaron and Amanda, and when they go into the party, there's a charm to them. The apocalypse shooting in that hospital, which was a real destroyed hospital in the beginning. Like it was all that stuff feels really great. But I think probably that big monologue with Zelko is because Trav and I were huge fans of Zelko. I mean, from going back from like Damages, just having him in that part was like a dream. And it kind of all is building to that moment where he says, I remember meeting you in 1987, but you have no idea who the fuck I am. Like, you need someone fantastic to get across all those ideas. And that to
he was brilliant. I remember watching each take he did was brilliant. And yeah. I was like, let's just put them all back to back.
Watch it.
Put them all in.
Travis, how about you?
Of any specific moment?
Yeah.
I think it is Zelko's one of them, but I mean, for me, when Cole kills Leland and the moment that he doesn't disappear and you see in Aaron's eyes that failure, that belief that he'd been holding getting shattered, I was like, okay, that's the kind of the heart of the show. And it all sort of snapped into focus and was one of the last things we shot, right?
Yeah. We were like 10 minutes before we wrapped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah. You know, I went back and I read your piece that you had written in the Hollywood Reporter about, you know, the best adaptations having something new to say. And that you all had something very personal to say about the nature of, you know, nature of time. And also, I mean, there's a line in the pilot with you break the past and the future follows. The show had a very different, more, you know, hopeful tone than the film in terms of what people can change, even if the characters are ultimately stuck in a loop. Looking back on the two of you starting out writing this story and then, you know, where it ultimately finished, and now you're 2 years later, and do you all have sort of any thoughts about this story and just sort of what it meant to you all looking back on, just thinking about when you just started this out, trading lines back and forth?
I will say that the kind of fatalism of the movie is not something you want to experience for 50 hours of television.
Right.
And I think when you take people on that kind of journey for that amount of time, you can't leave them with nothing matters, there's no point, thank you, good night. It's just, at least that's not something that I ever wanted to do, you know. In a 2 hour story, it can be interesting and it can be impactful, and it obviously was in the movie. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we had was, you know, what if they keep trying when maybe there's an answer out there and they're going to find it. And so we just wanted to pursue that.
Yeah, I think it's just when you state a series goal like the last survivors of humanity in Battlestar Galactica saying we need to find a home, we need to find an Earth, then that gives you a hope, right? It promises an ending of some kind. And I think the second you make that choice here in 12 Monkeys, which is we are going to change the future and undo this and save the world, there's a hope to that. And you can and for me, you kind of have to do that, and you need to do it in a way that's unexpected. So I just think that makes for better storytelling. It makes you want to like root for them, and how are they going to pull this off? Are they not going to pull this off? You know, you want to really believe that they can't. And I think that was, you know, I love when a new person starts to watch 12 Monkeys. You see it on Twitter all the time. They're like, they missed the point of the movie where you can't change time. I'm like, oh, I missed that? Oh, shit. I'm so sorry. I didn't know they couldn't change time in the movie. I'm like, yeah, I know. I've analyzed that movie. It's do you want to make that show? Do you want to make a show where the goal is finding a pure biological sample of a virus?
Over and over again.
Because, you know, or is it about humans? Like, do you want to be able to change humanity in a way that time itself can change? And I think that that's just a better story for television, you know? That's where that comes from.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, though, is that there's a lot of nihilism in TV and a lot of like misery, and the seed of what made this show different. You can read that pilot script. It's that hopefulness that ended up carrying throughout the whole show.
Well, that's good to know. We did something right, Trav.
Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome. This is great.
We appreciate y'all's time for sure.
Well, thank you guys for still doing this.
Next up, a discussion with costume designer Joyce Schur and Terry Metalis about designing costumes from 1491 to 2143. Thank you for listening, and until next time, we'll see you soon.